Let us assume that man with personal consciousness becomes by means of it able to understand a personal world of particulars around him. Yet with this particular or personal consciousness, man is not capable of understanding universal mystery. Man is only able to totally understand on a level. And here is something that's rather important to bear in mind. The moment the individual ascends above his own norm, his power to understand slowly decreases. The moment he descends below his present norm, his power to understand also decreases. If, therefore, man contemplates any form of life essentially less than his own, he contemplates it with no more assurance than he contemplates a life superior to his own. Man is therefore locked on a level. We might say, for example, that man's body, containing within it all the working parts of his own elaborate economy, that man should be capable of the experience of the parts of his own body, but he is not. Man is utterly incapable of experiencing the problem of his own heart. He is not able to experience in participation the project or problem of the digestion of his own food. To him, the mystery of his own digestion must be studied out of a book as though it belonged to someone else. He cannot experience the process of his own digestion. The only time he can get a little taste of that kind of an experience is when he has indigestion. Then he discovers that he is aware of something. But even this awareness does not prevent him from making the same mistake that caused the indigestion. Man is aware of pain or discomfort, but he is not aware of process. He cannot be very quiet and very still and experience his own digestion. He cannot be very quiet and very still and experience what happens to a nerve within his own body. He must consider even his own body as something separate from himself, something that he must study. He has to go to school with others to study the structure of body in common before he is able to examine his own. Yet this body belongs to him, and its energies are sustained by his life, yet he cannot share in it. If he goes upward into a world of more rarefied conditions of consciousness, he cannot, by moving inward, discover the nature of his own ideas. He cannot actually experience his own ideals. He cannot contemplate a superior state of himself, nor can he for one moment experience the consciousness of the orders or hierarchies which he believes are above himself in nature. It is very difficult for him to experience actually the wisdom of one of his own kind, slightly wiser than himself. And he certainly has difficulty in really appreciating one of his own kind who is a little more foolish than he is. He is locked within a very narrow gamut. And his consciousness simply does not escape, either upward or downward, under the normal functions of living. If, however, he enters into a state of contemplation, and he detaches himself from all worldliness around him, trying to absorb himself into the most subtle parts of his own being, could he then become sensitive enough to experience the functions of his own body? Eastern yogas tell us that he can, but that requires a tremendous amount of discipline and a very highly developed science, and that also that to experience a state of awareness superior to his present state requires a very high advancement in the yogic art. But these things will not happen by accident. But of course they will all happen gradually by evolution over long periods of time, because man is growing into new experience continuously. But until he actually experiences these things, he cannot cope with them. And consciousness, as consciousness, does not fill this interval. It does not make it possible for him to do that which is otherwise impossible. But the potential of consciousness seems to possess within it the power to accept growth by experience, so that experience never outgrows consciousness, but becomes a new instrument for its manifestation on a higher level. All these factors then contribute to another point. Thinking of personal consciousness, the individual, following the old concept of microcosm-macrocosm analogies, which dominated thinking for 1,000 years in Europe, became a habit, comes to the next conclusion. Is his own state of consciousness a key to the relationships of universal consciousness? If, for example, man is personal, and the universe is bigger than man, and must support many men, many beings, many creatures, may we justly ascribe to the universe a universal consciousness, even as we ascribe to the person a personal consciousness? We may certainly do so, but when we divide consciousness from personal to universal, what do we experience in the process of so doing? Do we know any more than we did before? In the majority of cases, we do not. Universal consciousness simply becomes our consciousness applied or projected by ourselves toward a state which we have not experienced, but which we must conclude is bigger than our state. Therefore, we come up with the idea that universal consciousness is greater. Because this universal consciousness is associated with God, it is better. Because deity is presumed to be all-knowing, this universal consciousness is omniscient. Because God is everywhere, this universal consciousness is omnipresent. And because God does all things, this universal consciousness is omniactive. But when we have said these things, what have we said? We have only tossed long words around. We have not actually experienced any of the factors involved. We have simply projected our own state upon the universe and assumed that as man has the awareness of self within his own nature, that the universe is ruled by a being also possessing awareness of self. Awareness of self by man is called personal consciousness. Awareness of self by deity is called universal consciousness. Because deity, being the universe, being the totality of existence, self-awareness for deity implies total consciousness. Yet, self-awareness as applied to man does not imply personal total consciousness. We are to assume that deity, by its consciousness, is aware of the sparrow's fall. But man, with his world, by his personal consciousness, is not aware of the infirmities of his own flesh. He may sicken and die before even recognizing the symptoms. Man is not aware of the burden placed upon the blood vessels of his own body. He does not have to carry the load of the smallest cell as a conscious experience in his own life. Yet, man as a person controls a body of which he is unaware and which he therefore frequently perverts to his own ambitions. Had he the consciousness of it, he would not do so. How then shall we affirm that universal consciousness is actually aware of us any more than we are aware of the cells within our body? We affirm these things, but we do not know them to be true. We also affirm them on the testimony of certain individuals who claim to have had certain experiences. We do not deny these experiences, But until these experiences can be so standardized that they can be examined by more than the handful of isolated witnesses, we cannot, on the other hand, totally accept without question findings about which we have inadequate information or substantial knowledge. We must keep many of these points in comparative suspension, because we simply do not know. I have a feeling, however, that if we are to search for the answers to these things, and psychology is desperately seeking these answers today, perhaps more than ever before, and in the future probably even more avidly than now, that we have to recognize that consciousness, as we wish to understand this, is more than merely universal cognition. I do not think that the actual definition of consciousness in terms of universal consciousness means universal cognition. I question if we will be able to supply evidence that consciousness is directly associated either with cognition or awareness. That these terms represent our effort to explain an aspect of consciousness rather than the total nature of consciousness itself. In all probabilities, consciousness is, as far as we are able to estimate, not conscious. In this sense of the word, that consciousness is a kind of an infinite potential which is capable of infinite unfoldment from within its own root. But the root itself is so completely remote to our experience that we have no adequate way of defining it. This does not mean that consciousness does not exist, but rather that what we know as existence is not enough to involve or enclose our concept of consciousness. Our word existence does not go far enough. No thought or term that we have goes far enough. No state of being that we can experience is close enough to consciousness to give us any clue to its essential nature. Perhaps the nearest clue that we have is this process of suspending a function that is not consciousness. But out of this suspension, for the most part, we arrive at a total suspension. We come into the presence of a timelessness, a beinglessness, in which, according to the testimonies of the ancients, and those who have experienced these things, we gradually lose sense of self-existence. That true samadhi, or true nirvana, as taught in Asia, is the complete suspension of the sense of self-existence. The individual reaches a state in which he is not aware. And furthermore, by this means, he also has reached a state in which he is no longer aware whether he is aware or not. The complete suspension of the state of knowing awareness. Therefore, in this instant, the individual escapes time and place totally. Consequently, what we call awareness is related to time-place association. We are aware of time and place, of the relationships of these things upon each other. Time, place, thing. All these are essential to awareness. The suspension of time, place, and thing causes the suspension of awareness. In that instant, man is unaware of his own existence or non-existence. So we study the problem as carefully as we can to discover, if we can, what the individual is cognizant of while he is not aware. Well, that's a pretty problem. In other words, it's an extension of the idea, what is he thinking about when he's not thinking? In the samadhi and in the experiences of Eastern mystics, there is a peculiar term which comes in, which I don't think has been much discussed in the West, but except perhaps among some of your old medieval saints. And that is this reference to blessedness, reference to bliss, and to a state of almost perpetual ecstasy, which seems to mark the profound, mystical, apperceptive mood of these saintly persons. Having transcended all personality, time, place, condition, there seems to be described a state of bliss, a state of timeless, measureless, beingless bliss. Now this has been explained and studied a great deal, particularly in your Oriental philosophy, to find out how an individual can be so blissful when he doesn't know that he exists. But he comes back with an answer which confounds the elders and leaves the entire situation in very much of a dilemma. Namely, that bliss exists. That he has discovered that a condition exists, but he does not. Which is the exact reverse of everything we know. Are we then to affirm that consciousness in its own nature, a priori, is the exact reverse of everything that we know? Is consciousness the opposite of every definition we have ever given it? Is consciousness, therefore, by its very nature, completely contrary in substance to the extensions of itself in matter? Is anything that appears to be good at one pole bad at the other? And is this consciousness, which we know as the continual urge to be aware, is true consciousness a complete suspension of awareness, presenting to us some dimension above awareness, beyond anything that we can conceive of with our present faculties and our present knowledge? Buddha took the position that true consciousness was not only incomprehensible to us, but different from anything that we have ever experienced, and making use of a series of instrumentations which we have no awareness of, that true consciousness is not extinction, but can only be discovered by the total extinction of every process that we use to attempt to attain consciousness. Inasmuch as every process that we use creates pressure, creates intensity, and builds a greater wall of illusion or misinterpretation around our awareness problem. So he took the simple answer that universal consciousness can never be known until it is experienced, and that when it is experienced, it is discovered to be, perhaps what the mystic says, not the individual aware of something, but condition itself aware of the individual. That there is a positive polarity in space. And that true consciousness is the universal being aware of the particular. Whereas consciousness as we know it is man as a particular forever seeking awareness of universal, or that which is separate from himself. Man seeking to understand what is separate, whereas consciousness is forever moving through that which is not separate, but is the same. Consequently, true consciousness is the discovery of sameness, or the total experience of sameness. Whereas our type of consciousness, our analytical consciousness, is constant awareness of difference. Socrates and many of the Greek philosophers worked very hard on this problem of consciousness, although the term was not very well known to them as we use it today. In fact, the type of consciousness that we refer to was unknown to them, because they had an entirely different attitude toward this entire subject. They held it to be self-evident among the Greek idealistic school that man was a stranger coming into this world, arriving here, having his internal psychic life drowned or intoxicated by matter, and that therefore he lived in this world in a kind of stupor from which he could only be released by discipline or by initiation into the mysteries. That if by virtue and integrity he lifted himself above the restrictions of his own body, gaining during life victory over his own senses, emotions, and desires, that he might then return again to the spiritual estate from which he had come. This concept was almost a complete pattern. The Greek mind did not go further than this, because it also dealt with the concept of metempsychosis, or rebirth, assuming that the individual would have to be reborn many times before the ultimates of consciousness were of any particular importance to him. This left the situation almost untouched, except that Socrates and most of the Greeks, including Pythagoras, pointed out clearly that the road to consciousness was the road to separation between worldly and divine matters, and that every individual seeking consciousness must attain this separation within himself, restoring to value those things which were valuable, and relinquishing such attachments as might interfere with the ultimate victory of the soul over circumstances. Thus, in the Greek, we have the beginning of the idea that man must attain some kind of a victory over a natural habit or inclination before he could experience the true mystery of consciousness. In the East today, as in long ago, this consciousness problem presents itself in a variety of ways. Zen has one approach to it. Lao Tzu, in his Taoist teaching, had another approach to it. But all of these approaches have to do with certain things. One of the points always emphasized is discipline. Now, how shall we understand discipline in relationship to consciousness? For example, how are we to assume that man's consciousness, being as it is more or less polluted by the condition under which he exists, placing upon him or making available to him a discipline superior to his own state? Yet we know this can happen in the ordinary life of man. We know that a man who has lived a corrupt existence, becoming aware of this fact, may place a resolution upon his own nature, by which he is going to correct these faults of character and restore his integrity as a person. Thus man may, by perceiving those around him, and being inspired by conduct superior to his own, or discovering that his own conduct is no longer suitable to his nature, may improve or change himself. Discipline implies this particular kind of adjustment. Discipline is a mature person placing certain restraint upon his own conduct. One kind of discipline is called lawfulness. It has to do with social adjustment, in which the individual restrains his conduct because certain conduct is dangerous and detrimental to society and opens him to punishment. There is another type of self-restraint which is imposed upon the individual who has discovered that excess is dangerous to his own nature. He has discovered that unhappiness, misery, sorrow, pain, these things have arisen from his own conduct. Therefore, he is inspired and impelled to make certain changes within his nature. Go further into this same policy, and you come to your philosophic theory, namely that discipline philosophically imposed is man's recognition that it is possible for him to control his own faculties, that it is possible for him to impose upon his own nature certain rules suitable for the improvement of his own total being, and that such may be termed discipline or penance, or may be applied by an obligation or an oath or by a voluntary commission. All of these things ancient peoples understood, and they made certain vows, and they took certain rites by which they dedicated themselves to the better conduct of their own lives. So in yoga and in most of the Eastern disciplines and in Christian monasticism, rules for the refinement of self were taught and were imposed upon those who desired certain spiritual advancements. And I think that in the majority of instances, these rules, though perhaps difficult, had numerous virtuous connotations. I think the loss and complete lack of self-discipline, which has so distinguished our modern age, is responsible for a large part of the trouble that we are now in. The individual failing to accept a responsibility to himself has lost the wonderful privilege of being stronger than his own desires. And lacking this experience, he has been unable to meet adversity with the strength and courage and dedication of which perhaps was present in civilizations less advanced technologically than ours. So that the possibility of self-discipline as in Zen or in Taoism must be given due consideration. Self-discipline in terms of consciousness is the individual assuming that there is a life within him that is part of a universal life, and that this life is by substance and nature either greater than the common life of the person, or else in potential is capable of greater advancement or of being able to support more adequately the improvement of the individual if he will make an effort in that direction. So the disciplines of consciousness assume that there is something in man which is capable of a better knowing of things, a better acceptance, a better understanding or appreciation than that which is commonly available. Ancient man then began to study. Modern metaphysics followed in the same general pattern. The effect of the mind upon the man, and have come to the conclusion that the mind, as the Indian classic, the Gita, says, can be and frequently is the slayer of the real. But man's mind, setting upon him certain personal patterns and habits, causes him to develop a kind of characteristic or a false kind of personality or temperament, and that the findings of this false temperament pass as findings of consciousness when they are not. And that when the individual says, "I," he is usually not referring to his center of consciousness, but to his intellectual egoism. That when he says, "I think," he is not stating the truth. He is saying what he says without consideration. Well, what he means is, the mind thinks. And instead of the mind being used to think by the I, the mind is its own master and is imposing its own requirements upon the self. Therefore, as Buddha points out, the individual says, "I want." This is a lie except in one particular. Buddha says that man can say, "I want," only in one way and make it honest. And that is that I want liberation. That any other desire except complete spiritual emancipation is not a desire of the I. Therefore, that the I does not want. The individual says, I like. Buddha says this is a lie. It is only applicable under one condition, when the individual declares a fondness or likeness for absolute truth. That nothing else arises from a proper level to say, I like, I want, I believe. To say, I possess, is false. And if there is a consciousness in man, this statement is an absolute contradiction to that consciousness. To say, I possess, is a false statement. Because I cannot possess. The only thing that can possess is my body. And to say I possess means that I assume that my body is I. To say I want is to assume that my emotions are I. To say that I believe means to assume that my mind is I. To say I think is to assume that the thinker is the self. And these assumptions are not true. Therefore, the terms that we commonly use and with which we are continually fortifying our own psychology, these terms are false. The longer we become addicted to them and the more strenuously we observe them, the more completely confused that we will become. And this has apparently been true because we have finally reached the pinnacle of all confusion. There is no way in which we can estimate greater confusion than that we have now, except by waiting until tomorrow. Then we will have a new experience of how much worse it could get. But now we have reached the apex of the conceivable. But actually, consciousness is none of these things. Consciousness impels none of these thoughts. Because in the substance of consciousness, they are useless. Actually, everything that the individual does, he does for one of two purposes, one positive and the other negative. Everything he is doing is either in order that he may approach reality or that he may depart from unreality. Everything we do in order that we shall be more happy or less unhappy. That we shall be more popular or less unpopular, more successful or less unsuccessful. Everything is either a positive or negative effort to move from an unsatisfactory condition to one that is satisfactory. How then can consciousness, which is total satisfaction, have any motion in it whatever? How can consciousness be escaping from anything or desiring anything? How can consciousness desire to be more than it is or to have anything that it does not possess? Havelock Ellis points this out in his mystical experience description, that in this transcendent moment he was desireless, that he lived in or existed in a state of such complete adjustment with existence that he realized that there was nothing missing. Nothing could be added. Nothing could be taken away. Therefore, everything for which we exist, which is to add or to take away, must cease to be significant. And the motivations that move all of us become non-operative. What is man, therefore, to do when all of his familiar motivations cease to motivate him? He apparently is suspended in nothing. But actually, in that state of suspension, he is for the first time at the end of a journey through unsatisfaction toward something. Now, we do not assume and cannot take for granted, even for a moment, that the universe ends in a stasis. That all dynamic is eternal, we are reasonably certain. That forms and types of motion and energy can constantly change, we know. But that energy itself can cease, we gravely doubt. We know that it may be subject to modification, that it may pass into forms beyond our comprehension or conception, but that it shall cease once it moves is beyond our certainty, at least. Therefore, we have no reason to assume that man ends in a suspension of a heavenly state of bliss which leaves nothing to be desired and permits nothing to be present that is not desired. This would be a complete suspension, a complete end of everything. What we are therefore probably dealing with is that we are bringing the individual out of the well at the bottom of which he has been existing, as in Plato's legend and fable of the well, that what we call nirvana, or the total extinction of man's escape and defense patterns, is actually the release of man's consciousness as fact. And therefore, at that time only, is the truth available, inasmuch as error has ceased. That actually, under those conditions, man passes from a prenatal state, which is the one he's in now, into a condition of birth, being born out of ignorance into a state of reality. That state of reality is therefore comparable to our concept of consciousness. But under the present condition, we are simply unaware of it, being no more able to remember or recognize it than we are to remember our state before birth. Yet that we had a state, we know. What it was, we do not know. That we have a state beyond us in the future, superior to our present, we are convinced by instinct within us. What it is, we do not know. But we can only assume that it is more than the absence of itself. That whatever is less perfect is moving towards a condition superior to its own state. We do not wish, however, to be caught in the thought that the pushing of the present condition into the future makes it perfect, nor that the complete satisfaction of any pattern that we now hold means security. What we are trying to achieve is the realization that there is an integrity, whether we know it or not, like it or not, believe it or not, accept it or not, and that it is toward that integrity we are moving. And that integrity may or may not agree with anything we now believe, but that we are approaching it by trial and error, regardless of any other efforts that we make. And your disciplines imply that it can be approached by discipline also. Discipline merely being the exhaustion of error by character rather than by accident. Under these conditions, man is capable, perhaps, of so suspending error in his own thinking and in his own formulas that he is capable of the experience of consciousness. That he will be able to experience it completely in body is unlikely. But that he can experience a shadow of it, a sensing of what lies beyond it, is conceivable if he performs these disciplines and follows in the footsteps of those who have led the way to these supernormal experiences of awareness. That brings us then to the next step in our problem. What is the difference between universal consciousness and universal mind? Universal mind, apparently, has always been held as a demiurgus, or as a secondary deity. The universe brought into existence as a mystery of consciousness. Therefore, creatively engendered by consciousness which is creative. And creativity is the principal difference between consciousness and intellect. Intellect is not creative. Consciousness is. Wherever intellect seems to create, it is because of consciousness content that is behind or operating in pattern with intellect. But universal mind becomes the regulator, the administrator of the world of in which man exists. It was therefore sometimes referred to as the third logos. It is the world mind or intellect, the imposer of regulation, rule, and statute. And the world under its intellect becomes a rational animal moving in space. Plato so defined the world. When the Greeks referred to the world, they referred to what we would call the solar system, or perhaps even the universe in some of the connotations that they had of the term. So the world as a mental entity is a mental autocracy in space. Even as man, as a thinking or mental creature, is a self-governing unit, governed by reason, intellect, or mind, governed according to the quality and capacity of individual and collective intellect. The mind, in turn, deriving its authority, substance, essence, and energy from world mind. Man with mind can become the thinker. But mind has never yet satisfied the inclination of man in his search for truth. The mind is not capable of the experience of truth. The nearest that it can come to it is the organization of reasonable facts. Therefore, the mind can discover the reasonable. The emotions can discover the good. But only consciousness abides in the substance of the real. And reality is beyond that which is either reasonable or good. The reasonable may be only reasonable in terms of relativity. The good may be good only in terms of relativity. But the real is unchanging as the root behind all change and phenomena. Therefore, in classical thinking, consciousness is associated with reality. And that being is said to be conscious, which is capable of apperceiving reality. And that being is considered to be enlightened, whose true nature is regulated by the reality locked within itself. This reality is not mental, but man has created a false reality which he has imposed upon himself. And perhaps the false reality which he has imposed is best exemplified in his materialistic culture. For in materialism, he has established a world ruled over by the concrete faculties of the mind, which have become a despot of realism on a material level, realism as opposed to reality. Well, they are not the same thing. Materialism, rationalized, has become our way of life. And it is also promising or threatening to become our way of death. This carries with it the ancient belief that consciousness differs, therefore, from reason in its experience factor and in its creativity. A thing thought out is not a thing lived through. Thought is a kind of vicarious laboratory process. The individual can think about many things which he has not experienced and will not experience, because he can read about them and think about his own thoughts. Consciousness, however, is rooted in an experienced reality. It is rooted in the individual's power to say, I know, without exaggeration. The power to know is not the power of reason. The power to know is a sensitive field within the individual, which either can receive the total impact of a fact, or else is capable of so energizing its own nature that it can discover the fact in things around itself. Therefore, the question has been asked, and perhaps with validity, is the difference between objectivity and subjectivity in this sense, that error is the result of external things moving in upon the individual, and reality the result of the individual moving out upon things. This could be a valid comparison if we do not push it too far. I think there is no doubt in the world that consciousness discovers value in things, and that it does so by an intentional purpose. That consciousness coming in where intellection ceases, searches for that which the intellect cannot find. Intellect, for example, can discover character and motive. Consciousness, however, seeking reality, seeks the experience which led the individual to his conduct. And as we go further and further in this, we discover that the mind judges, but consciousness does not. That in some mysterious way, we refine the same thought that Jesus gave to his disciples. The mind says, judge righteous judgment. Consciousness says, judge not at all. For with whatsoever measure ye judge, so shall it be judged unto you. Condemn not, lest ye be condemned. In other words, mind passes judgment, consciousness suspends judgment. And there is a constant situation. This suspension is not due to the individual merely following the rule not to judge. Consciousness in some way takes the edge out of judging. It takes the pleasure out of judging. It lifts the individual from the mental exercise of the either-or Aristotelian mode and causes the intuitive recognition of value so deep that the individual no longer feels qualified to judge. Therefore, the persons with least mind have most fixed opinions, whereas those whose knowledge is greater hesitate to express an opinion, simply because the more they know, the more aware they are of what they do not know and how much more there may be to any problem that they can possibly perceive. Thus, as consciousness increases, man's immediate mental certainties decrease. And you can have a mental bigot, but you cannot have a bigot in consciousness. Because consciousness is a thing in itself impersonal. And bigotry has to be intensely personal. So wherever we contact consciousness as we know it, or as we perceive or believe it, we observe one thing, that there has been a great motion of humanity. We come back to Bacon's concept of observation as one of the basic instruments of knowing. There has been a great motion of mankind from the beginning of time, a motion in which man has sought to discover reality as it is referable to himself. We have observed also that in this motion, certain individuals, certain times, beliefs, attitudes, doctrines have come forth, and that down through time, we have gradually come to most admire, most deeply revere and regard, respect and consider as admirable persons with certain attitudes. We have also gradually come to observe that persons with those attitudes have been vindicated by history, that with the gradual passing of time, these persons have been proved right, whereas those with different or other attitudes have not been proved right. Thus we have a certain experience framework to indicate the correct or general motion of man's awareness. We know in general the kind of awareness that has made better people. We know the kind of awareness that has enriched cultures and has given us all that we have of nobility and beauty and truth. We know the kind of awareness that survives death and causes persons to be discovered, honored, and revered centuries after they are gone. We also find that this kind of awareness is seldom accepted by their contemporaries, and that whereas those popular in their own day have disappeared or been forgotten, those clinging to certain broad, unchanging patterns have been remembered after their own time and still are remembered, and that among those with certain attitudes, the immortals of our remembrance have been selected, and that these persons continue to influence the world and have always influenced, since their own time, at least certain groups. We know, for example, that Plato is read today a million times more than in his own day, whereas many great names of his time are not even remembered to us. Thus, certain types of thinking have not only moved individuals, but have contributed to the permanent motion of peoples, of cultures, have led to the gradual building of sciences, for upon certain foundations that must have been true, the sciences that we have gradually developed were developed. Had they been essentially false, we could not have built upon them. So there are attitudes, there are beliefs, there are teachings that have survived simply because of a strange integrity locked within them. These patterns give us some concept of what constitutes the direction in which man is presumed to be moving. We know that such consciousness as this, such attitudes as this, are exemplified by the Sermon on the Mount of Jesus, by the words of the prophets of ancient Israel, by the wonderful discourse of Muhammad at Mecca, also by the first sermon of Buddha, seated at Sarnath along the side of the Indian Road, and in the wonderful works of Confucius and Lao Tzu, that these have all struck certain identical chords, and that man has instinctively known that these were right, regardless of how he conducted himself. Thus, out of this, we have a direction of consciousness. We know that this direction has caused us, for some reason, to admire most those who, forsaking all other things, have clung to truth, and those departing from all personal or selfish ends have dedicated themselves to the common service of their fellow men. These persons have lived. Therefore, the search for consciousness or the experience of consciousness is bound into this pattern so far as we are able to understand it. And if there is a way toward consciousness for man, it is in this way of gradually decreasing selfishness, decreasing personal ambition, and the gradual elevation of universal value above personal value, that such a compromise of position, that such a change from our common pattern, has caused great sorrow and misery to these people, we know. Yet in themselves they were greater than their sorrow or their misery, and out of them has come historic martyrdom. Individuals who were perfectly willing and gloriously ready to sacrifice their lives to protect others or to preserve principles and convictions which they regarded as greater than life. Thus we find the evidences of the courage, internal resource, and strength bestowed by certain convictions, as opposed to the common weaknesses resulting from certain other convictions. From these broad factors, we must finally come to the conclusion that man has accepted subconsciously, whether consciously or not, has accepted subconsciously that there is a consciousness superior to intellect, that this consciousness has an existence apart from intellect, that this consciousness is impersonal, universal, and in its essential ideals and principles, seeks to bind up all differences, unite all discords, and reflect or reveal the common unity within life and living. That this consciousness has to do with the mending of broken things, the overcoming of all separateness, man's outgrowth of egoism, selfishness, ignorance, and superstition, and that within man is the vision of this need, and that discipline comes to him as he gradually clarifies this position and seeks to gain the strength of internal resource available to him once he begins to move in harmony with it. And the search for consciousness for man today seems to be the result of a dedication by which he resolves to move himself with consciousness, toward consciousness, and dedicates himself to those ends which, to the best of his conviction, represent the proper and natural ends of consciousness, as differentiated from the intellectual and emotional ends which he has previously cultivated and which have led to discord and disaster. So we have this experience of consciousness, of man seeking to do those things which man's universal experience has demonstrated to be right, does gain greater courage, greater insight, and greater internal strength. And from these circumstances, may assume that at this present stage of his growth, this is the direction which it is proper for him to take, and that therefore he gains the support of consciousness by dedicating himself to those universal values which he senses within himself, and which, if they have any origin at all, certainly originate in consciousness rather than in the selfish, separating factors of his ordinary existence. So the individual dedicating himself to his superordinary self, to that which is beyond his common, daily purposed self, finds that he gains greater strength, greater ability, greater respect and honor, and achieves greater good. For these reasons, he assumes that such motion on his part is motion toward consciousness, or with the approval of consciousness, and that he is rewarded by the release of greater understanding from within himself, this understanding being that part of consciousness which he conceives it to be possible for him to sense, know, or understand. So with this as a preamble, we have to proceed next week, but I think perhaps we've done enough for one warm evening.